Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, August 10th, 2014. This is episode 1108. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 prepaid Visa card when you get a loan. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. And it's time to talk about computers and the internet and smartphones and home theater. Our digital photographer, Chris Marquardt, will join us shortly to review our assignment. Lots of good stuff. If you're into technology, this is a great show for you. If you'd like to get into technology, or you'd like to get better at it or understand it, this is a great show for you. 8888 Ask Leo is the number. We'll welcome questions on anything with a chip in it, or suggestions, or comment. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. You can also call us via Skype from anywhere else in the world. We do have people do that all the time. And, of course, you're welcome. You can listen all over the world and call in also. It's a global thing, isn't it, technology these days? We also have a website for your perusal. That would be techguylabs.com. And that's a good thing to keep in mind because you can get there all the stuff I talk about, links to the stories I mention, answers to questions. You can even get audio and video from the show after the fact. 1,108 shows total. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number, though. That's the main thing to keep in mind. My friend Nick Bilton wrote an interesting article that's kind of timely these days. He writes for the New York Times, and he talks about getting in something called a flame war. Do you know what a flame war is? Everybody's experienced one. If you've used social media and you've expressed an opinion on any subject, you've probably been in a flame war. And it's been particularly tough right now because of what's going on in Gaza. That will really get those things going. Nick writes for the New York Times. His disruptions column is kind of a blog, I guess, of life in the New York Times. And he talks about starting to write about something online and a friend texting him saying, abort, 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 stop. Fortunately, the friend didn't do it in public. But it's so easy to get into this stuff accidentally, almost. It's the August 7th disruptions column, if you want to read about it. And I'm wondering if any of you have experienced this. And it makes me wonder whether social media is the right place to express opinion. Or maybe it is, but just step back, perhaps. Step away from the Twitter. Maybe that's the solution. Nick's a great guy. He's a very sweet, kind guy. But as it has happened to me many times too. And he interviews a bunch of experts about why this happens. And there are a number of reasons. Of course, one of the issues, and you've seen it since the days, earliest days of email, is text doesn't express nuance very well. If you're being sarcastic, for instance, it's not obvious. He says, you can say, yes, I agree, in a tweet, and people can interpret it as sarcasm, like that you're being, that you're mocking them. Or maybe you are really agreeing and it's not obvious. He also, the other problem, of course, is that it's instant. And it's so easy to quickly say something, fire something off without thinking about it. He interviews a conflict expert, a person who deals in damping down the kinds of things that are going on right now in the Middle East. And he said one of the tricks they use in conflict resolution is slowing it down. That if you respond, fire back and forth, you're much more likely to say and do things you regret than if you take it a little slower. You have to relax. That's why a lot of times, this is actually a technique that's prescribed by social media experts. People will say, let's take it to email. Or even let's take it to direct message. Let's take it out of the public. That's part of the problem with Twitter and Facebook, too, is that you're not just having a conversation. He says it's as if a husband and wife were having a fight in front of an audience on stage. You're really playing to the crowd, aren't you? People are aware of the fact that everybody's seeing these fights. And so you ramp it up. You play to the crowd. It's a great article, worth reading, Nick's advice is abort, abort, abort. Don't do it. And we're seeing such vicious arguments right now and name-calling going on over conflict in the Middle East over Israeli and Gaza, whichever side you take. And it mirrors the viciousness of the actual battle, minus the bloodshed, of course. And I don't think it furthers things. I think it just ramps everything up, steams it up. I deleted Facebook and Facebook Messenger from my phone today. You probably noticed, this is a trend now, isn't it? That Facebook, the app, says you no longer can use Messenger or any messaging at all in the Facebook app on the phone, iOS or Android. You have to install their Messenger app. You have to have two apps, not one. And messages will go to Messenger. So I did it. I'm a good boy. I installed Messenger. All of a sudden, I'm getting little chat heads popping up all over my phone, not just when I'm using Facebook, but all the time. And I thought, oh, rats. Of course, I installed a new app. I should turn off the notifications because I don't want to be notified. I want to check the messages when I want to. I don't want little bubbles popping up while I'm trying to use my phone. So I went in, and you can't. You could turn off notifications for 8 hours. Or a day. No, I can't remember what it is, but for a limited period, and then they come back on automatically. You cannot turn them off permanently. You can in Facebook, not in the new Messenger app. Furthermore, others have pointed out that the Messenger app tracks you all the time. This is a battery killer. Even if you don't mind the invasion of privacy, it's a battery killer. It sits there and watches everywhere you are, presumably to update your location and your messages. But... boy, it just doesn't. It's invasive as heck. So I had to say I was happy to delete that, the two of them. I'm not deleting my Facebook account, but I'm going to leave it for when I'm home in front of a computer and I can take the time to respond to the messages. And I don't want to see them all the time. No control is not a good thing in an app. You will not, starting on I think on Wednesday, at least for some of us, be able to use the Facebook app for messages. You have to adopt Messenger. And they have changed the capabilities of the program and the permissions of the program. Facebook says, no, these your concerns are overblown and based on misinformation. It's Android's fault. Well, okay. All I know is I can't turn off notifications for more than 8 hours, and that's no good. Sorry. That is on Android. I don't know what it is on iOS. I don't want to see bubbles. I don't want to see it. I guess on iOS, somebody in the chat room is saying, you know, you can turn it off. You can turn off location services. You can turn off bubbles. But can you turn off notifications in general? I mean, can you say, I don't want to be notified about messages? I don't want to see the messages. Yeah. And it is the only app that I know of that will not let me turn off notifications. Notifications, understand, are a battery drain. You know, we're all trying to get the most battery life out of our phones these days. And when a application goes out to see what's going on, it has to wake up the phone. Whether it turns the screen on or not, it has to wake up the phone, use juice, and go out. And if you can't turn that off, then you can't prevent that behavior. And I think you need to be able to at least have control to do that. So bye-bye. I don't mind. It's just time sink anyway. We could talk about the Russian hackers who claim, and, you know, we haven't seen proof of this yet. Actually, the hackers don't claim. It's a security firm claims that a Russian hacking ring has more than 1 billion online credentials. That means login and password. I'll talk about why I'm skeptical in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Look who's back, Heather Hammond. She took about 8 weeks off for her birthday. She's back now. It feels like it was 8 weeks. We missed you, but welcome back.
That's way too cute. 8 is my lucky number, so that you nailed it.
I think, welcome back, Heather.
Nathan even missed me.
No, Kim Schaffer was great. She filled in beautifully, did a wonderful job. But did you have a good birthday? You had a birthday in New Orleans, which is, I think, the perfect place to celebrate. Was it fun?
Or to kill yourself.
Yeah.
If you don't like the age you're changing.
Was it a bad age? Was it one of those odometer
Every age
ages?
Is a good age. It was an odometer. It was,
Yeah, I don't like those. I don't like those at all. I got one coming up.
Oh, you do?
Well, 3 years. But, you know, when it's the big 6-0. Those 3 years, you can see, it's a long highway coming right at you, the train down the tunnel.
You can see the arrow flying at your forehead.
Right in my head.
It's just a suction cup. It'll be fine.
Oh, God. Hey, we've been doing a great job. I see you lining up calls. The board is full. I don't know where to start on this lovely list of fine characters. Do you have a pick?
I do. He's having a birthday, too, soon. Patrick in Burlington, Mass. And he wants your help asking his parents what to get.
Thank you, Heather. Hello, Patrick. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
How are you today? Which birthday's coming up for you? The big 1-5?
I'm turning 13.
You know what? That is a big birthday.
Yeah.
In many cultures, that's you're becoming a man. Yes, I know. That's a laugh, isn't it? So, what can I do to help you turn the lucky 13?
So for my birthday, I'm on the road a lot, so I was wondering, I was looking at the tablets, but there's so many on the market.
You're on the road a lot? You long-haul trucker, something like that?
I'm usually just out with family and stuff, and it'd be
That's
nice
cool.
to, have someone with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, are you on Skype right now? What are you talking to me on? It sounds like you're on a...
Yeah, I'm using Skype, yes.
Yeah, so I hear your computer mic. That we get a little room tone when you do that. So, So what kind of computer do you have? Windows or Mac?
I have a Windows.
Windows machine. And you like Windows?
Yeah.
There are Windows tablets, that are from some pretty good choices. There's two kinds of Windows that you can get in a tablet form. There's the big boy Windows 8.1 Pro, and Microsoft and others sell tablets. Dell sells an 8-inch tablet, the Venue Pro, a lot of people like a lot. And that's full Windows, although, using a full Windows on a tablet, there's no... It's a tablet, so it's kind of an odd mix. But you do get Microsoft Office and the desktop and everything in there. It's just an 8-inch screen. It's kind of hard to tap those little tiny buttons. There's also Windows RT, which is designed for tablets specifically, but I'm hesitant to recommend that because of mixed signals from Microsoft. They were going to announce an 8-inch RT tablet. They had a big event scheduled in New York City just a few months ago, and at the very last minute, I'm talking days before, their new CEO, Satya Nadella, he replaced Steve Ballmer, who replaced Bill Gates at Microsoft. Just keeping you up in case you haven't been paying attention. No, Bill Gates is not the CEO. It's a guy named Satya Nadella. And at the very last minute, we think Nadella decided to kill the announcement, which had been planned for months. And somewhere in a warehouse, Microsoft has now admitted this. They admitted this on their quarterly call. They didn't say exactly, but they said, we have a product that we thought we would ship but didn't, and we've got quite a few of them in a warehouse somewhere, and we're going to write that off as a loss. Makes me wonder if they are ever going to release this RT tablet. And if they don't, that means I wonder if RT has any legs. So if you're going to get a Windows tablet, I'd get one that is running Windows, as I said, big boy Windows 8.1 Professional. That would probably be either the Surface Pro 3, which is very nice, but maybe a little bigger than you're looking for, or the the Dell Venue Pro. Toshiba has an 8-inch, too. There's a number of 8-inches. Then, of course, there's the iOS stuff, the iPads. These are the most popular tablets, although sales have been plummeting for the iPad last two quarters. That mostly, I think, because, A, people know there's a new iPad coming in the fall, or expect one. We don't know, but expect one. And, B, because, well, everybody who has an iPad, wants an iPad, probably has one by now. They sold so darn well for years. And then there's your Android tablets, which are certainly the low-cost leaders and offer some, you know, some nice features. Samsung makes some high-end versions. Google sells a very nice, inexpensive 7-inch, the Nexus 7. So of, I'm sure you sound like you're pretty savvy. Of those, of that group, you probably have a feeling for one or the other, do you?
Yes, I was actually looking more towards Android.
Good, all right. So that narrows it down. I love the Nexus 7 if you can get it. They're still, Google itself is not selling it on their Play Store anymore. They say they're out of stock.
Okay.
But you can go to a lot of stores, Best Buy and the like, that still have those in stock. And they're very, very good. Beautiful high-res screen. It's a 7-inch tablet, which makes it very portable. What do you do when you're on the road? You want it for playing games or for tweeting? Or what do you want to do with it?
I want to play a few games on it, and sometimes I have some, like, on-demand content, like videos, and sometimes I even watch Twit on the go.
Oh, thank you, our podcast network. Well, there is a new boy in town that's great for gaming. It's the NVIDIA Shield tablet. Have you heard about that?
Yes, I have.
Now, it's a little more expensive. I don't know how much mom and dad want to spend for the 13th, but as I said, you're becoming a man. This is a big deal, mom and dad. $300, not a lot of money. The Shield is easily the best gaming tablet out there. Amazing. And NVIDIA's commitment to gaming means that there will be peripherals like controllers that will make this an even more exciting tablet. The people I know who have one, including my friend Aaron Newcomb, are blown away by the NVIDIA Shield. It is probably the fastest tablet out there. It's got a Tegra 1 processor in it, which, by the way, most many Android tablets should have soon. $300. It's one of the things I like a lot about it. It's got speakers on the front, left, and right, just as the HTC One does. That makes it great for video as well, because the speakers are where they ought to be. $299 is the Wi-Fi version with 16 gigs. If you're doing it on the road, you might want to. Do you watch YouTube gaming videos, Twitch gaming videos, that kind of thing?
Yes, I do.
You're that kind of guy?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. You, by the way, I bet you don't watch a whole lot of TV, do you?
No.
Do you ever watch TV at all?
No.
You're sending chills down all the folks in New York City who know that people under 20 don't watch TV. They watch YouTube. They watch Twitch. That's why YouTube is expected to buy Twitch for $1 billion. Because this is where the future is. It's not on television. Do you ever watch Netflix?
Yes, my family does have Netflix.
Your family does.
I don't do it.
You don't do it. Everything you want is on YouTube and Twitch.
Yes.
Yeah. Get your dad or mom to buy you the NVIDIA Shield. That is definitely the tablet for you. You're a gamer, I can tell. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, thanks to the chat room. I was talking about at the beginning of the show how I had to uninstall Facebook and Facebook Messenger. Facebook now requires you use Messenger if you want to use the Facebook messaging system at all. You have to install a second app. And in Messenger, I wasn't able to turn off notifications permanently. I could turn it off until 8 a.m. or for an hour. Those are the choices. Which means that as soon as an hour goes by or it's 8 a.m., it comes back on. I guess that's like turn them off overnight. But the chat room pointed out, and this is great, this is a feature of Android that I quite like. And I don't know, I'm using 443. I don't know if this is in all versions of Android. But if I go into the settings and go to apps, I can go to the Messenger app and uncheck show notifications. And this, I think it might be a CyanogenMod thing because I'm running CyanogenMod, but it says enable Privacy Guard. When Privacy Guard is enabled, this app, I think this is CyanogenMod, will not be able to access personal data such as contacts, messages, or call logs. There you go, Google. Now, I have a feeling that by doing this, I'm basically broken Messenger. So I'm not sure that's a solution any better than uninstalling Messenger. But just a tip, if those chat head bubbles are bothering you, you could just turn off notifications, not globally, but just for Messenger. 8888-ASK, Leo. I said I was skeptical, but now I have to say maybe I'm not. You probably heard the story that Russian hackers... Here's how we got the news, from a guy named Alex Holden. He's a security researcher. His company, Holds Security, revealed this. That a Russian gang has stolen 1.2 billion email accounts and their passwords. And I was skeptical, partly because of the large number, although that's not unheard of. But 1.2 billion is like, you know, almost everybody. Okay. It's a pretty good number. But also was a little skeptical because Alex Hold said that if you paid him, I think it was $250, he'd tell you if you were on the list. And that I thought, But a guy I totally respect and trust, Brian Krebs, who writes the Krebs on Security blog. For years he was at the Washington Post, really one of our foremost journalists covering security. He says he has seen the list. He says it's true, so I believe it. I believe it. Revealed, as many things will be at this big hacker conference that's going on in Vegas, Black Hat is over. That was this week. That's the expensive one. And now DEF CON, which is for the hobbyist hacker. And I say that only because I'm many hundreds of miles away and I feel safe here in my fortress. Love you guys. Don't mean any disrespect by any means. DEF CON and Black Hat often are a source of new hacks. We learn about stuff because researchers all year, you know, everybody, look, they're all going for fame and fortune, right? So if somebody like Alex Holden finds something really juicy, he's going to hold on to it and announce it in the forum where it's going to get the most attention, and that's Black Hat or DEF CON. So we're hearing a lot of things coming out, including bad USB. And I will talk about bad USB in a little bit, but I'll give you the bottom line on this. This seems to be genuine. It is a real concern. Turns out many USB devices, including USB mass storage devices like thumb drives and hard drives, are easily, or well, easily may not be the right word, are hackable in such a way that the hack cannot be detected. Turns out, most of them have on the circuit board attached to them, not in the memory itself, not in the storage, but in the circuit board, they have a little storage there that can be programmed. That storage contains what we call the firmware, and you've probably updated the firmware on a computer or on your phone in the past. It's just like that. It's updatable. And given the right circumstances and the right tools, a bad guy can update the firmware in such a way that it's not only undetectable, but can infect any machine it's plugged into. So bad USB is a very serious problem. We don't know the extent of it, although I believe Intel has already reported some cases of it being discovered in the wild. So maybe it is detectable. I don't know. So it's a pretty serious security flaw. It happens every year this time. We hear about these terrifying security flaws. Don't worry about it. That's the other story. Don't worry about it. The idea that you can achieve perfect security in technology is false. You can't. Nothing is perfect. Everything can be hacked. To think that you could achieve security means that you're going after something impossible and you'll be nervous for the rest of your life. It's good to take certain precautions. We talk about those all the time, things like turning on second-factor authentication. When I just logged into Facebook Messenger, it had to text me a special code for me to do the login. I had to have the name, password, but then I also had to have that phone in my possession. That's second-factor authentication. Those are good things that are very helpful in mitigating an attack, but it is impossible to have a totally secure environment. So relax. Don't worry. No, chances of you being hacked are small. 8888-ASK-LEO. 888-827-5536. And if you have a comment, a suggestion, a question about security, I'd love to talk to you. Let's go to line two. Bob is in Warren, Pennsylvania. Hi, Bob. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Leo.
My pleasure. Hey.
Hey, I just wanted to get a suggestion from you. I'm not 13 anymore. I'm in my 50s, and I still watch TV.
It's just you and me, guy. This is why the network's got to be panicked. They got to be panicked.
Well, I got this one, and it works good. Everything and all. I have a Roku attached to it. And I did cut the cable about a year ago. Yeah. And I watch you on Twitter all the time on there, and you look great.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, but, I mean, I'm running an internet television network, and I'm panicked.
Right.
I'd hate to be NBC, CBS, and ABC.
Yeah. Well, this is a 10-year-old unit, and it's a CRT type.
Yeah, that's ancient. Time to get a new one. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but it works great. And the thing is, you can't give them away. And I just wonder if there's a green way to this.
That's a very good question. Yeah. You
know, like in a few more years, I'll probably be in a market for a flat screen.
I've told this story before. I'll never forget walking down the street. Some years ago, the TV everybody wanted was a Sony Grand Vega, WEGA. They were very expensive, gorgeous, beautiful televisions. But CRTs, you know, giant. I saw one on the street the other day. It said, free, take it if you want it. That's how valuable these are. Probably a $2,000 TV set in its day, and nobody wants it because they're so big, right? Flat screens eliminate that whole thing behind your TV.
Yeah, and it weighs about 300 pounds.
Yeah, so almost every community now has an electronics recycling program. Sometimes they call it e-waste. In fact, they were an advertiser on the radio show some years ago in Los Angeles because everything that is electronic has to go to e-waste. It cannot just be put on the curb. It cannot be put in your recycle bin. So you need to inquire if somewhere in Warren, I'm sure they do, has a e-waste recycling center. And they know what to do. And there are absolutely some very specific things they need to do with that TV. There's some heavy metals in it. The tube itself will implode if it's broken, and that can be dangerous for people around it. There's lots of issues. So you're very right. You need to find a e-waste recycler. Erie County, New York, I mean PA, I guess that would be, has electronic disposal days, and that's pretty typical. You'll get a notice. Look for that. That's where batteries go too, believe it or not. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by Prosper.com. I should mention Prosper because I love this idea. This is Silicon Valley's answer to borrowing from a big bank. Prosper does what we call peer-to-peer lending. It brings people with money to lend together with people who need to borrow money. And it really has been quite a successful solution. Just think, if you could get up to $35,000 in just 72 hours, what would you do with it? Would you pay off your high interest rate credit cards? I would. Maybe do that home improvement project. Not a bad idea. You could even start a business. Prosper is simple. It's easy. It's online. You just go to prosper.com/twit. You'll see a very simple application. Doesn't ask a lot of information. But you can fill that out, provide a few details, and immediately get a rate quote. Now, a couple of things to know. These are fixed rate loans, low interest rate. They're unsecured. There's no collateral involved. Multi-year terms are available. And you don't have to go to a bank, hat in hand. Please, sir, can I have some money? You can do it all online. Prosper has more. It's so successful. It's done so well. More than 2 million members, over $1 billion in loans funded so far. And many of them have come from our own listeners. I've talked to a lot of people who've used Prosper to get a little extra cash for something they need to do. Go to prosper.com/twit. Check your rate. It will not affect your credit score to do that. And for a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 prepaid Visa card when you get a loan. Hey, that's nice. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Pretty good deal. Prosper.com/twit. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion. A lot of what we are doing on this show, and if you listen day in, day out, you probably realize that, not only my radio show, but the podcasts we do all week long on twit.tv, is really kind of have ringside seats to watch the world change dramatically thanks to digital technology and the internet. And everything, and we talked earlier about how kids today don't watch TV.
completely putting out of business a massive industry, right? I should have asked if he goes to movies. I presume he goes to movies. That seems to be, that industry seems to be surviving. But he doesn't watch, he doesn't sit down in the living room as we used to do and watch the television. Music has changed dramatically. People don't buy CDs anymore. They may not even buy music anymore. I would guess the younger people just listen to Spotify or RDO or one of the radio solutions. You pay $8, $10 a month, and that's that. That's your music budget, and you can listen to anything. I was watching, going through the TV guide the other night. And now I understand why literally half of the programming is reality programming. Literally. Reality. It's cheap. Cheap and easy to make, and the people who still do watch TV seem to like it. I think we've seen the future for network television. Fortunately, oddly enough, talk radio seems to be surviving. Because you're in the car, and you want to hear people talk and have companionship, and this medium seems to survive. Of all things. I'd hate to be a music station these days in radio. But talk radio seems to have survived. Michael, knock on wood. Michael in Long Beach. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm well, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine. I have a Windows 7, and I have more than one computer in the house. And my router, my Wi-Fi seems to work fine, but one of my computers, the desktop, seems to lose the router. Like I can be using it now, and 10 minutes later, it will say it can't access the websites. If I either restart my computer, it will start working again, or if I unplug the router and plug it back in. But it's my...
Now, I don't think it's the router or the internet, because other computers don't have this problem. It's just this one computer.
Right, it's my computer.
Yeah.
Something. So what do you suggest that I can do?
That's an interesting. It's not unusual to see this with routers. As they heat up, they often stop functioning, or if there's something wrong with it, they stop working over a period of time. But a computer, generally, if it has, is this desktop distant from the Wi-Fi access?
No, it's right next to it.
Yeah, of course it is. Right next to it. See, if it was distant, then maybe that would explain why it's dropping out once in a while.
As a matter of fact. I could be wrong, but I think this one's hardwired. I think the other ones are the only ones that use the wireless.
Well, this changes things dramatically. I thought you were on Wi-Fi.
I didn't explain it correctly.
So you're on hardwired. All right. Well, there's probably an issue with your Ethernet card. Once you get that plugged in, you know, it's not going to be the the waves going through the air. I would replace the Ethernet cable, first of all. That's the cheap and easy thing to do. You probably even have another one lying around. So just try plugging another one in. If it's not the cable, and the only reason the cable is probably unlikely, but at least it's an easy thing to test. Then it might be your network interface. Now, on most computers today, that's built into the motherboard. That's not an easy thing to fix if it's a hardware issue. If it's just a driver issue, go into the network control panel, remove the interface and reinstall it just to see if that works. You want to try to do all of the simple things. This is how troubleshooting works. You go through, starting with the easiest, step by step, all the potential causes and hope that you can narrow it down.
Isn't it has something to do with it's losing its address or IP or whatever it is, the computer's
Well,
IP?
Yeah, but computers don't just lose their address. There are things, you know, could be a software issue. There could be malware on your system. There are other things it can be. It's just, I can't, you know, obviously.
Sure.
I can't tell what's wrong with it. But what you're going to want to do is slowly go through these processes. If you have another, if it's a card, internet, network interface cards are not expensive, Ethernet cards. Try another NIC. If it's on the motherboard, download updated drivers. Remove the network interface. That's actually at a higher level than the driver. That's the software that controls the network interface. Reinstall it. Make sure you don't have duplicate IP addresses. So make sure the settings on your computer are proper. In other words, where it says allow the computer to configure the IP automatically or the router, do that. Don't set an IP address in there. That kind of thing. And chat room is right. Jim in San Diego does suggest you, if rebooting the computer works, that probably means that a simpler command would work. If you open up a terminal, you know, remember DOS? Click start, run CMD, and type the word ipconfig /release, and then ipconfig /renew. What it's doing is it's telling the network interface, drop the IP address you gave me. Let's start over and reconfigure. And that would probably fix it. If you're on a cable modem, sometimes the cable company will keep track of your MAC addresses, and that might be another thing, is to not just unplug the router, well, but unplug everything and then start from scratch. I'm just trying to think of all the things that can be wrong. There's a lot. And this is annoying, Michael, I know. It's one of those kinds of problems where it's called an intermittent problem. It's hard to duplicate. It's very hard to track down. Anne in Long Beach. Hi, Anne. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi.
You have a new high schooler.
Yeah, well, she's in 10th grade, and she's very computer savvy. Doesn't watch TV.
You see? You see what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's amazing.
I know that kid. Yeah, she's 15, and she decided she wanted a desktop because she wasn't going anywhere. You know, with the laptop.
That's good. You know what? As a parent, you love that because there's no chance of it being lost or stolen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But she wants it so she can watch television. Well, you know, Hulu and
yeah.
Netflix. Yeah.
So I think an iMac is an excellent choice for a desktop computer in either the living room, or she's in 10th grade. You probably trust her. You could put her in the bedroom, too.
Yeah.
They have beautiful screens. They have 21-inch or 27 inches. I'm sitting in front of a 27-inch. I would watch TV on that in a heartbeat.
However, what's the price? I'm trying to stay around $400.
Oh!
Oh!
$400, eh?
No.
Well, no Mac is $400, so we're going to eliminate
That's
that.
Right.
When you go to $400, understand you're not getting high-end components.
No.
You're getting the squeal more than the pig. You're getting the ears, not the pork chop. You're getting the hot dog, not the roast beef. You understand that?
I want it all.
I know. Everybody does. But $400. Go to Dell. Dell has desktops at $400 that are absolutely fine. And you'll find something there. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, and all that jazz. That was my litany in the earliest days of the show. Now in its 10th anniversary, but I've been doing this since 1991 on the, you know, answering technology questions on the radio for 23 years. So I've seen it all. And I have to tell you, computers are cheaper than they've ever been. And you can get a pretty fine computer for around $1,000 now. That would have been $2,500 a few years ago. So prices have tumbled. I mean, they're half what they were for comparable power reliability. Unfortunately, consumers' expectations have fallen farther and faster in the same time. And we now have it in our heads, thanks to netbooks and other cheap solutions, that we can get a good computer for a few $100. You can get a computer for a few $100. And Microsoft's working very hard to make sure. But one of the ways they're doing this is by giving Windows away for free to manufacturers if the screen is small enough. I think 9 inches. So there really is a push, a drive to the bottom. But I have to warn you that an inexpensive computer is going to be less reliable, not so easy to use, not going to have as good a keyboard. If it's a laptop, the trackpad's not going to be very good. The screen's going to be lower quality, lower resolution. You have to give up something. However, I am completely sympathetic because at the same time, the economy's tanked. Nobody has money to burn anymore. We all want the best for our kids. So I've done a little searching. There's a Dell factory outlet, dell.com/outlet, where they sell current model Dell computers. Most of the time when you're getting it from the manufacturer like this with a full warranty, a current model, it's merely that somebody bought it and changed their mind and they returned it. box has been opened, can't sell it as new. Law prohibits that. So they have to sell it at the outlet. Sometimes you're going to get the end of the line model, the last three computers of a model that's been discontinued, but they're still in good shape, relatively new. I'm looking, I did a little searching on the Dell store, and I like the Inspiron 1. I like the one computer from Dell. That's the all-in-one. That's their version of the iMac. It's a screen with the computer guts inside, perfect for a teenager's room, not a lot of wires. It's compact. This is a decent size 20-inch screen. It's not the fastest computer out there, but it's plenty of power. 4 gigs of RAM is good. A 500 gigabyte hard drive is great. It's got a 2.4 gigahertz Celeron processor in it. That's not the top of the line, but it's fine. And this is $469 on the Dell outlet. So that's, I think, you know, this is probably, spec-wise, it's a fine computer. And I think she'd be fine with it. Not that, you know, 20-inch display running at a lower resolution. It's not, you know, high def. It's 1600 by 900. Technically, it is high def, but not super high def. I think this would be fine. I also have to tell you, I think in a lot of respects, people shouldn't be looking at Windows PCs at all, or Macs. They should be looking at Chromebooks. A lot of schools now are buying Chromebooks. In fact, I think the Chromebook has something like 20% market share in education now. It's huge. This is a product that runs an operating system from Google called Chrome OS. It really is just the Google browser. So you can do email, you can browse. They have a lot of plugins. There are a lot of programs you can run. It's fine for a student because you use Google Docs, which many schools use, for word processing, spreadsheet, you know, presentations. I think in many cases, that's a great choice. And those aren't very expensive. They're laptops, though, not desktops. I think they make a Chrome box you can attach to an existing display and keyboard and mouse, and that'll give you a desktop. I think for a lot of people, that's all you need. We had a great conversation this week on one of our podcasts, This Week in Google, with Jeff Jarvis, who's a professor of journalism at the City University of New York, writes books. He's written a number of books. Very well known, travels a lot. He says, my Mac died, and I think I'm not going to buy another computer. I'm going to stick with a Chromebook. I think that's all I need. Because, you know, if you write, that you can write on a simple computer. If you're a pro photographer, Chris Marquardt's coming up at half past the hour, that's probably not a good choice. If you're a video editor, obviously not. If you need a truck, it's not a great choice. If you need a high-powered pro system. But most people don't, and they overbuy. They buy too much complexity. So another way to cut the cost is to get a Chromebook. We just got Michael a Chromebook. He's in sixth grade, 11 years old. $200 for the, Asus C720, I think it was. $200. And it's fine. And it's not the end of the world if it breaks in a couple of years. That's fine. So I don't think that's a bad choice. But if you've got to have a Windows computer and you've got to have a desktop, I have been able to find, with a little digging, it's not immediately obvious on the Dell outlet store, some decent choices in that $400 to $500 range. Dell.com/outlet. They're not a sponsor. I like their hardware. In fact, when we buy Windows machines for the, we don't, generally most of our employees want Macs, but in the business side, they want, we're using QuickBooks and spreadsheets. They want PCs, and we get Dells. In fact, our editors, actually, this kind of was a little bit of an eye-opener for me. For a long time, we have 8 edit stations. And for a long time, our editors were using high-end Mac Pros running Final Cut Pro, which is the video editing software that everybody uses. But unfortunately, Apple seems to have abandoned that market. We bit the bullet. We bought Dell PCs, high-end Dell workstations, expensive workstations, very, very fast as the current Mac Pro, faster in most cases, most respects, less money, running Windows and Adobe Premiere. And the editors are excited. So maybe at times it's changing. That's the truck, though. Not everybody needs that truck. Steve in Chatsworth, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
Well, I've got a photography problem. I'm not that good with computers, and I'm not very good with photography. I have a Rebel, Canon Rebel XT camera.
Nice camera.
And primarily what I do is take pictures of small metal parts that are usually black. And in order to get the detail in the parts, I have to have a lot of light.
Yeah.
But then I get these horrible shadows.
Yeah.
Is there a way to have a background that will drop away or some way to get rid of the shadows?
You bet. Are you selling these on eBay or something?
If what?
What are you doing with these parts? You selling the picture? Are you selling the parts on eBay?
No, I manufacture items. And
so you put them in your catalog?
Like catalogs, yeah. Yeah.
So a number of companies make exactly what you want. It's generally designed for selling stuff on eBay. Anybody who sells objects wants to have a good quality picture on eBay of it. And what you need is what essentially a photographer has in the studio, what they call seamless background. But you don't need a big one. You need a little one. So there are a number of, if you search for eBay photo kits, I'm looking at one that's available from B&H Photo. It's from a company that calls itself Polaroid. I guess they bought the name. But it's exactly what you need. It has a tripod for the camera, a couple of lights, and a seamless background inside a box. The lights are outside the box. The walls of the box are translucent, so they're diffusers. They spread the light around. Your problem, and I'm sure you've discovered this, is with a point light, you get very brightly lit small portion. The rest of it is in darkness because the camera exposes for the brightly lit part. You need a diffuser.
I really don't want to get that sophisticated. I generally take pictures in sunlight.
Okay, that's another solution. Leo Laporte, VTech guy. Hey, you know, I thought we got this question about how do you take pictures of really tiny little black gears with his Canon Rebel XT1. And I thought, you know, if only there were somebody who knew all about digital photography, who could help us with this. And lo and behold, there he is, ladies and gentlemen. with the creaky microphone, Chris, he doesn't, Chris Marquardt, our photo guy. Hi, Chris.
I wasn't expecting you to get me on this early, but that's awesome.
Well, you're early. Did you hear the, but I thought he's here. Maybe I could bring Chris on. So what do you suggest? How would you take pictures of little tiny parts? They're black. He says he's been doing it out in the sun.
Yeah, well, the photo kit that you suggested is a very good suggestion. That will kind of give you a consistent light situation, so you're not dependent on what's out there. But having that said, the color, doing this in the sunlight is actually from a color, from a spectrum point of view, it is the best light that's there. Our daylight is better than any artificial light that we can buy.
Why is that? The color of it, you mean?
It's the color. It has all the different parts. You know, the red, the green, the blue parts in the spectrum are there. And with some of the fluorescent lights that you get with these photo kits, that's not as complete.
Actually, the one I was pointing out, $45 at B&H Photo, had daylight balanced light. And that's probably why it was, they want to make it that color of the sun. I guess if it were a cloudy day, it'd be fine because that's a diffuser over the sun, right?
The problem that the caller said is he's doing this in the sun, and the sun is, you know, the sun is huge. It's huge, but it's so far away that in fact for us it's kind of like a point light source. And what does a point light source do? It casts harsh shadows. You know that when you look at the shadows that you cast when the sun shines on you, they're hard edged, and that's what gives him all these shadows. What he could do is he could use a diffuser. That's like a reflector, but it's slightly translucent, and you hold this over what you want to shoot. So pretty much you kind of generate, you create kind of a cloud cover above what you're doing there. And that will that will diffuse the light and make it not as harsh and take care of some of those shadows. So that might be an idea that he might want to look into. But I would personally probably use a photo kit like you suggested, because that is...
And you can do it on your counter. You don't care.
You can do it whenever you want. You can do it at night. You can do this whenever you want.
I think most of the people I know who sell on eBay do something of the sort. They have a seamless background. That means there's no corner. It's just a smooth curve.
Yes,
and
that helps.
Diffusers around it, and they have multiple lights, and that way you get a nice, smooth, even light. You don't get those really bright hot spots in one particular place. No glare.
Yes.
Seems like the best way to do it.
That's how it works.
All right, Chris, go back to whatever you were doing. I just thought, I've got an expert here. Let me pull him out and trot him out here and give him your expert opinion. Chris Marquardt will join us in about 10 minutes to talk about our photo assignment. He'll have his reviews of three of our best pictures from Flickr and our Flickr group. Meanwhile, back to the phones we go. And Robin in La Jolla, California. Hi, Robin. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yes, hi, sir. I'm calling about the black phone.
There's yes.
$629.
Yeah.
And have you seen one? Have you worked with one? What is your opinion of those?
As far as I know, no one has. It's a Swiss company, blackphone.ch. Yeah. And the idea is, as everybody knows, as everybody who's ever watched a Bourne movie, Jason Bourne, always when the girl who's being chased by the bad guys gets in the car, the first thing he does is he takes the phone, takes out the battery, smashes the phone, and throws it out the window. Why? Because a smartphone is the perfect tracking device. Not only does it have GPS, it's always online broadcasting your location. Plus, it has a camera and a microphone that can be turned on remotely with the right trickery, and that's even better for espionage. So the idea of the black phone is it's a secure and private phone. However, I guess you can purchase it. Let me just see how much it costs.
$629.
The issue is it's secure and private only if you trust this company. Because anybody who makes something can put bad stuff in it without your knowledge. You know, I have a Chinese-made phone from a company called OnePlus. I just figure it's probable the Chinese military could spy on me. I don't really care. It doesn't really matter. But they, you know, there could very easy, because you can't look inside this phone and see what they've put in the firmware. That's the problem with this bad USB hack. You can't examine the hardware to see what it's doing. Now, the company that makes the black phone is Silent Circle, and Phil Zimmerman, who created PGP, is part of this. It seems like a trustworthy group. It's in Switzerland. I mean, if you can't trust Switzerland, who can you trust? But understand that just as you're trusting Apple when you buy an iPhone, you're trusting Samsung when you buy a Samsung phone, you're trusting a company called Blackphone when you buy a Blackphone. And the guarantee that it's private, I have no idea one way or the other. Here's the issue I have in general. People seem to want to use the internet. People want to use smartphones securely and privately. It ain't possible. And the only way to make software, computers, the internet, phones totally secure and totally private is to break them, to take away the functionality that makes them useful. If you want to go on the internet with the black phone, you're on the internet. I don't know exactly what you want to protect yourself from. It does come with special apps. Again, not open source, so we don't know what's going on with these apps that claim to be private. I guess, you know, this is possibly more private, but it's not guaranteed to be more private. At least it's not $1,000. It's about the same price as a standard smartphone. It's 4.7 inches. It's 720p. Not a super fast processor, but it's okay. A gigabyte of RAM, again, not state of the art. This is more like a Moto X. 16 gigs of storage, LTE. It's got a camera and a microphone on it. To me, that seems like right there, that's a problem. I presume it's running Android. I think the mistake that people make is the assumption that you can somehow make something like this completely private and completely secure. And I don't believe you can. And I believe you have to trust this company that they're doing it that way. Now, if I were a federal law enforcement agency interested in snooping on the public, one of the things I'd probably do is create a company that supposedly makes a private phone, because I figure anybody who buys this phone is definitely a target. What are they trying to hide? I feel like, you know, when President Obama took office, they took away his BlackBerry and gave him a secure Windows phone. You know, one of the things it didn't do? Email and the internet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. He's back. He's Chris Marquardt, our photo guru, joins us every week when he's in town to talk about digital photography and the like. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Leo.
Welcome
so we want to talk about an assignment today. We
oh, good.
Are going to review the goal assignment, and I've sent you an email with all the links in there, so
let's
you can bring up the pictures.
It's a little weird, I know, folks, to talk about photography on a radio show, but we're going to do it. So
it works remarkably well, actually.
To people who don't know what we do, in fact, we're going to give you a new assignment, so you could participate. And you don't have to have a fancy camera. It's fine to use your smartphone, but we're going to give you a topic or a subject, and we want you to go out, shoot a lot of fresh new pictures on that topic. And
yes, and it'll be up for about a month, a bit longer than a month, so people have some time to go out and maybe join the tech guy community on Flickr, which is, I don't even know, over 10,000 people.
You have to
besides.
To submit.
It's huge.
So, yeah, that's how it works. You have to be on Flickr. And if you're on Flickr, which is free, by the way, Flickr is a Yahoo property, so you probably already have a Flickr account, frankly, then find the Tech Guy group, the 10,000-plus member Tech Guy group, and join us, and we will, we'll give you a new assignment. But first, goal! Did most people go for soccer?
Not really. I mean, soccer is kind of over. The World Cup is over. So in the aftermath, yeah, there are a few soccer-related pictures. But the ones I chose, actually only one of the three I chose to review here is soccer-related. So the first one, let's look at the picture shot by 420 Buddy. And
420 Buddy.
420 Buddy, yeah.
All right.
That's his name. And it's... Well, it's a road, and the road leads into the depth as roads do. There's a perspective there, and there's some dust there, so something must have driven there really fast.
I think this
almost looks like
homage to Breaking Bad. I think, but I might be wrong.
Possibly the colors are interesting because we have a beautiful blue sky on the top and this orange road on the bottom. Very kind of a primary color contrast there, and it tells a bit of a story because something has been driving there really fast. Roadrunner cartoon comes to mind as well. So there's the dust and something is heading towards a goal. So I like the way that that the submitter kind of chose the colors. And there's definitely some color tweaking going on in that picture. That's pretty much
a given. And blue and yellow are complementary. Do you need to understand color theory to be a good photographer?
Well, not really, but it does help. I mean, this is a very primal contrast, the same as red and green. So if you shoot picture of tomatoes, the green parts are important to kind of counterbalance the red.
Yeah, yeah.
You could also go tone in tone, but and there are lots of different ways to combine colors, but the primary color contrast, red green or the orange blue kind of contrasts are very strong contrasts. They kind of pull you right in there. You should watch. You should look for movie posters. They use those color contrasts.
Right, right.
Really, really. Almost all of them do.
Our next photo from Gerald Wiley.
Yes, Gerald Wiley shot a macro photo of bees, I guess, on a flower. So the reason, well, they have a goal here, so they are kind of at their goal.
Yeah, gathering pollen, yeah.
Gathering pollen and nectar. And it's really hard to shoot a good macro photo because you have to have to be very steady. There's not much depth of field when you go very close. So, you know, not a lot is in focus in the picture. So getting that right is important. And I bet that Gerald shot a lot of pictures to get this. And I like it how those petals kind of make leading lines towards the middle, so everything points to that middle. Everything points to those bees and to the yellow middle of the flower, and it's just beautiful.
You know what I do like about this? Of course, the color choice: the yellow of the pistils and the or are those stamen? I can never remember. The red of the leaves, The bee's wings are, you know, some are steady, but one of the bees is clearly flapping his wings and it's blurred. And
and you see the motion, yeah.
You see the motion. So this is a very lively, for a still life, which this is essentially, it's very lively. I really like, and yes, when you understand how hard it is technically. The background
is black. It is really hard to shoot live insects. You know, some of the insect macros you see, on some of those, the insects aren't actually that alive anymore. So seeing something like that where it's clearly shot in a live situation, that warms my heart. It's beautiful.
And finally, from Ann Wortham comes an actual soccer picture.
And that's it's a little boy standing in front of a soccer goal, shouting goal. And I just love this photo because there's so much life in there. You see the boy's face; he's just so into it, and he's shouting at the top of his lungs. And you can really tell that he's so involved here. And that just I like that. I like when there's actual emotion happening and. There's lots of emotion in this shot. And it's a black and white, which kind of simplifies things. Or there's nothing distracting in the background. No red or greenish things in the background that kind of pull your eyes away from the subject. The focus is on the boy, too. So it's pretty clear that this is about this boy and about the emotion that he's going through.
So many people have pictures of their kids playing soccer. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard... I know, because I have a lot of soccer, lacrosse, baseball, and football. All my kids played all the sports. It's very hard to get a great image.
Get close. That's all I can say.
Yeah, there's a lot of drama, and there's a lot of action. But this is just the boy by himself standing in the net and yelling. It's just so dramatic and beautiful. And it's nice when you get a great picture.
He could be yelling. He could be yelling to his teammates.
He could be yawning. Frankly, I mean, we don't really know. But that's the great thing about a story like this. The great thing about a picture like this, it tells a story, and it's up to the viewer to determine what that story is. I love it.
Exactly.
Very nice. All three of you, thank you for your submissions. Thanks to everybody who submitted pictures illustrating goal. You can see them all. We'll put links in our show notes. But you could also go to our Flickr group and just look for everything tagged with goal and see all the individual images.
We have a new assignment.
What is our new assignment, Chris?
Well, I did ask the chat room for suggestions this time, and Harlequin gave us one, and I liked it so much that we're going to do this. It's upside down.
I like it. Upside down. So you all understand how this works. You just the idea is to get you out there taking pictures. You could be with your smartphone. It could be with your super fancy digital SLR. It could be with your film camera. But the idea is to pick one great image illustrating the idea. We don't tell you much about it, just whatever that means to you of upside down. When you get that image, upload it to Flickr, FLICKR.com. And add it to the Tech Guy group. Renee Silverman, our moderator there, will welcome you. If you're not already a member of the group, we'll accept your photo. Make sure you tag it with upside down. You want to make that two words, upside, space, down?
That's a very good question. Let's have Renee decide and put it in the
okay.
Rules. When you go to the Tech Guy group, there will be rules that you can read, and it should be in there. I guess upside down is one word. It's probably easier to have it as a tag in Flickr.
Yeah, I guess you're right. All right. But Renee's great at that stuff, and she'll get you in there and get you.
Oh, yeah. She runs the whole place.
And do go visit, because there's so many great amateur photographers adding their pictures to the group every day.
11,465
wow. Really
members, over 3,700 photos in that community. It's wonderful.
That means some of you have not submitted photos, so get going, okay? Everybody can play.
That's true.
You'll find Chris Marquardt at discoverlightroom.com. That's where his great Lightroom book is. He's got a podcast called Tips from the Top Floor and workshops all over the world. And joins us every week to talk digital photography. Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. The website, techguylabs.com, will have everything we talk about, including links to all the images Chris just reviewed and all of that. techguylabs.com. Let's go to Portland, Oregon. That's where Chad is waiting patiently with another question. Hi, Chad. Leo Laporte.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling.
So I am a professional ballroom dance choreographer and...
That's cool.
It is. Most people say that.
Yes, thanks to You Think You Can Dance and Strictly Ballroom. We've all become fans of ballroom dancing. That's neat.
Yeah, it'd be awesome if more people came to classes because of that, rather than just watching it on TV.
Yeah, get off your duff and start dancing.
Yeah, I promise it's a lot more fun to do than to watch.
What type of dance do you like? Do you choreograph all kinds? Or
I do everything in the ballroom family, so everything with that you do with a partner. But my passion is really the Latin-style dances.
Oh, yeah. I don't have the hips for that. I stick with the West Coast swing. I can't really... The samba and the... I got to work on the hip movement there.
Next time I'm in Petaluma, I'll come in.
Will you give me a little lesson, would you please? Yeah.
No problem.
Thanks, Chad. So what can I do to help?
So I produce shows for my students about twice a year, and I try to go as professional as I possibly can. I get lighting and atmospheric effects and everything and rent out a theater.
Wow.
And I'm at the point where I've choreographed probably 200 to 300 pieces over the last decade. And I want to start capturing them, so taking videos of them. And so I started a GoFundMe project to get...
Oh, that's great.
Some good camera equipment and a good computer.
Tell me the address. GoFundMe.com.
/FundEdge. Edge Dance Sports or Edge Movement Arts is my company.
Fund Edge.
Yes.
All right. Dance and acro... what is acro?
Acro yoga. It's a partner-based...
Oh, I see people doing it. That's my goodness. Wow.
Yeah, it started in San Francisco, so it's big in your neck of the woods.
And you've raised $1,000 so far. Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you. Yeah, I was able to get a pretty good computer with that $1,000, so now I'm hoping to start getting a good camera. What I'd love is something like the Canon 5D Mark III, but you know, I'm not sure that the $3,000 is going to come in or not. I was looking for other... options for something that's like broadcast quality.
Sure. Now you're recording live performances, or are you able to do multiple takes?
I do live performances, but we do multiple shows, so we can do.
Okay.
We can create.
And the reason I ask that, you know, we had a visitor the other day who teaches film in Los Angeles at LA City College. And they now call their film courses, they can't call it film anymore because it's not film. So they now call their film courses single camera video because movies are made with a single camera. But of course, with a movie, you do many, many takes. You'll do a master take, then a close up, then a reaction shot, and assemble it all into an edit. And that's what we expect, what we're used to when we watch videos. And so many times, the videos you'll see on YouTube are a single camera, all right, but one take. And it's a medium shot, you know, center of the auditorium. And it's not what we want because it's not what we're used to. If you watch So You Think You Can Dance, you'll see immediately. In fact, I think they do too many close-ups because I want to see more of the dancing.
But, I agree with you. Sometimes they
understand the audience wants to see the face. They want to see the emotion and so forth. But so it's a mix. But clearly, a single medium shot for the whole dance is not what you want.
True, yes.
What you really would like is you'd like a shot. It's hard to do without a camera operator, frankly. You'd like a handheld that is moving around the whole time, capturing feet, capturing faces, capturing emotions. You want to keep that master middle shot. You might need two cameras or three cameras if it's a live performance. Now, if it's not a live performance, hey, then one camera will do. You're just going to have to do multiple shots at different performances. They may not match up very well, but that'll give you something. It's a little hard. You understand why it's difficult. I watch Fred Astaire movies all the time to look at how they cut. And many's the time, even with Fred Astaire, where you say, gee, I'd really like to see a medium shot here. I want to see what his whole body's doing, not just his feet. So you got to solve that problem. That's challenging. But I'll help you with the technology. The reason I bring this up is because a single camera may not be the right solution. You might want to do what they do in TV, which multiple cameras of the same performance.
If I get the money, I will get as many cameras as I need.
And one of them needs to be handheld because while you can lock down on a medium shot, the dancer is moving around, so you can't lock down on their feet. They're going all over the place. So you're going to need some camera operators, too. So that also changes things. The problem with a 5D or one of the DSLRs is, generally speaking, they can't shoot more than, say, 20 minutes continuous. They overheat.
Oh, okay.
So you really do, in fact,
want to have camcorders. This is a good use case for camcorders, and they happen to be cheaper. They're not as good. A DSLR not only is going to be a bigger sensor, but is going to have interchangeable lenses. So you can have a long shot. You can have beautiful depth of field where you're very tight, you know, focus on just the dancer. You can do a lot of different things. The problem with the DSLR, though, it takes a pro shooter as well because the focus can be very finicky, things like that. So a camcorder might be a good choice. We use what do we use here? I'm sorry. The Canon Vixia camera line for our broadcast stuff. And with good lighting, it's pretty good. That's, by the way, another challenge if you're in a theater. It feels like theaters are brightly lit. They're not.
Yeah, so we've had this issue with the autofocus. Like when the lights come up, right. You get
it pumps.
The autofocus, yeah. Repumps and everything. Yeah. So
we use the the GH20, which is about $1,000. You should be able to get a good camera for this purpose for maybe $500 or $600. That would give you a few. You might even, if you want to get modern, think about a GoPro for a point of view camera. I know that's a little weird, but that's kind of what the kids these days like, is to see what the point of view was. GoPro's made their business with helmet cameras, body attached cameras that show you what it looks like from the skier's point of view or the skydiver's point of view, and those are pretty amazing too. I would look for a camera that supports recording to flash. I think all of them do nowadays. The reason is much easier to ingest it into your computer. Are you using a Mac with Final Cut or?
I use the Adobe Creative Suite, so I've been playing around with After Effects. Perfect. And Premiere. And
that's actually a great choice, and that could be Windows or Mac. That doesn't matter. In fact, that's what we've moved to. After Effects is a great kind of special effects 2D effects generating program, and of course, Premiere is a very, very high quality editing program. I think almost any inexpensive camcorder will probably do you well.
I know a few years back I was listening to Mac Break Weekly, and Alex Lindsay was talking about, I think, the HDMI out of all these camcorders.
Some of them can. I wouldn't worry about this, but some of them can get very high quality out of the HDMI port, but that means you need a separate recorder.
Okay.
That's very expensive. Your budget for this GoFundMe is $7,000. One camera plus recorder is going to be about that much.
So
we can easily run this up. I would look at, also, somebody's saying, and this is probably true, that some of the Micro Four Thirds cameras, like a Panasonic GH4, would have be less expensive, have interchangeable lenses, and be better at video. The GH4 really is an amazing camera for video. But it's $1,700 and it's a smaller sensor than the Canon. So while it's a great video camera, I'm not sure I'd recommend it for this particular use. You could put a zoom lens on it and stuff, but it's gonna bust the budget pretty quick, frankly.
Okay.
It's expensive to do what you want to do. I think camcorders are the right choice because you can get more of them. You know, you can get sub-$1,000 camcorders and still be well within your budget.
Okay.
All right. And you don't need to shoot 4K because you're not going to put 4K video up on YouTube. You're going to put it on YouTube? Is that the end goal?
Yeah. I mean, I've done some stuff. I'm on YouTube already with a lot of the stuff I've done over the years. It's just the quality that I'm hungry for is not there yet.
Yeah. You know, that's the beauty of using something like the Canon, the 5D Mark III, is the video is 4K. It's super high quality. You get beautiful effects because of the lenses. And then you're going to get a great still camera, too. Maybe you just get one of those.
I'd love to.
And then shoot in the studio, not in a performance, because then you can control the light better. You can do multiple takes. You'll get a great thing. GoFundMe.com/FundEdge. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers and the internet, home theater, digital photography, all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO is the phone number. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada.
Moving on to David in Irvine, California. Hi, David. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. I am a longtime fan of Call for Help alumni, in fact.
That's awesome. Thank you. That was the TV show I did many moons ago now. Oh, man.
Very nice to speak with you.
Yeah.
I am a graphic designer slash inventor slash entrepreneur. And, you know, I do all of my own design and marketing work, including video and websites and all that stuff. And my problem is that I'm working on a laptop that just turned a decade old. And I'm now looking for a replacement, but I'd like to go with a tablet since they've gotten so powerful. I've heard that the Surface 2 or 3 can handle Photoshop or Illustrator, but I haven't been able to find anything with Adobe loaded so I can actually test it out. I'd like to know what you think.
Well, the Surface Pro 3, which is the one I would consider, especially if you're a photographer, because it's got the best screen. In fact, arguably the best tablet screen out there. It's a full Windows computer. You can get it with an i7 processor. It's by default an i5 processor. It's got sufficient mm-hmm. RAM. Of course it can run Photoshop. It's a standard computer. The difference is the form factor, not the hardware inside, the guts.
Oh, okay.
So
there's no stuttering. It doesn't run.
No. That's an you might. Now, they just started shipping the i7 version, so you probably want to spend a little more. It's not cheap, by the way. The Surface Pro, once you get add the keyboard, which is another $129, we're talking a fairly expensive computer. And if you're going to get the i7 version, I think you're paying as much as you would for almost any desktop computer. Over $1,000. Let's put it that way. Let's see. Here's an i7, 256 gigs of storage. That's one thing you give up in any tablet is the storage isn't going to be as much as one with a spinning drive, but let's
right.
$1,549, and then you're going to have to add a keyboard because that keyboard is an accessory. It doesn't come with a keyboard. But I have to say, people rave over the quality of the screen.
Now, you mentioned the Shield. I've never heard of that. Is that comparable? Or
it's Android. It's not going to run any Adobe products.
Okay. I see.
So if you want Adobe and you want a tablet, I think you're going to probably go with Windows. There's no Mac tablet, that runs Adobe, runs Photoshop or any of the Adobe Creative Suite. Yeah, I mean, you can put Light. So a not a bad solution is an iPad with Lightroom. They have a free Lightroom app. And as long as you use Creative Cloud on the desktop, you'd still need a desktop computer. You can do some Lightroom-style editing. You can select photos. You can do some color correction and so forth on the iPad, and it synchronizes with the desktop. I actually do that, and it's a nice combination for quick and dirty. But if you're talking about you're full-blown, this is going to be my computer.
Right.
Yeah. Surface Pro 3 is a good choice, but you're going to get the i7 variant, and that starts at over $1,500.
Okay, well, at least the cost is comparable.
Yeah, and by the way, you will be able to use a stylus, and it's pressure sensitive and all that. So it may be a really, I haven't tried it, but it may be a great experience if you do a little photo editing and color correction and so forth.
Yeah, that's great. My main concern is how it deals with video and
It's an i7. This is like I said, the guts are the same as any computer. It's the external form factor. You'll be surprised how thin and light they are. They're under 3 pounds. They're very thin.
Great.
You'll have to get the key. You probably want the keyboard if you're going to do any sustained keying.
Yeah, and even though it's a touchscreen, I'll still use a mouse. That's got a USB attachment, right?
Yeah, it does. You can use a USB mouse, or the keyboard has its own trackpad built in.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Great.
I think this is a good choice for you. Now, one thing you are giving up, it doesn't have a standalone GPU, graphics processor unit. You're using the native Intel graphics.
Right.
The Iris graphics. But I think that's probably fine. A Gaussian blur might take a little longer than usual.
Sounds good.
I don't know many people who use the Gaussian blur, but if you do, but that's the one they always.
I do. Do you? Quite a lot.
Oh, well, hey, okay.
You'd be surprised.
All right, there you go. I always wonder because that's one of the harder things to do processor-wise. And Photoshop will offload it to the GPU if it can. So benchmarking the Gaussian blur is a good way of benchmarking the system. So if that is something you use, it will not be as fast as a system that had a dedicated NVIDIA video card, for instance.
Right. Oh, Great.
All right.
You've been a big help. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Yeah, I think these Surface Pro 3s are, if I'm not a Windows fan by any means, but if you're going to, if you need Windows, or, well, this is a perfect example. There is no Macintosh solution like this. There's nothing. And so you have to use Windows if you want to use Photoshop or Lightroom directly. 8888-ASK, Leo, the number. I think Jeremy's on the line from Los Angeles with some advice for our last caller from the last hour. Hello, Jeremy.
Hello, Leo. That is correct. My name's Jeremy. I'm a production coordinator in Los Angeles, and I also produce a whole bunch of little short films as well.
So you know your stuff. So to recap, our caller from Portland is a dancer. He's a choreographer for ballroom dancing, and he wants to shoot videos of his performances for posting on YouTube and other uses. And he's wondering what kind of cameras to get.
Yes, to kind of piggyback on the suggestion of the 5D Mark III, I would... Everything is Faustian, so everything always has a give and take.
It's all a bargain, yes.
Yes, but I will say that the 5D Mark III has a full-frame sensor, is what they call it. If you're just looking for HD film, or HD quality, rather, even the Rebel T2i has the same sensor, generally speaking, as the 7D, the Canon 7D.
That's an APS-C sensor, a little smaller than the full-frame, but less expensive.
Yeah, precisely. The 5D Mark III is the first, or Mark II is the first one that has a full frame, but it's six times expensive. You can get a T2i for $600.
That's a very good choice. And then you can use all the different lenses and so forth.
The lenses are the same. No one would know the difference unless you're blowing it up over 2K. Now, remember the movie Hidalgo with that big Disney flick?
Right.
That was shot in 2K. Thank you very much.
Most movies were, until very recently, shot in high def, not in ultra high def.
Yeah, and the whole deal is it was a movie full of effects, sandstorms and stuff like that.
On a big screen. On a big screen, too. Blown up huge. Yeah.
So the whole deal is he can buy three T2i, Rebel T2i's, Canons. He's going to spend way more money on lenses than he would on the cameras.
Jeremy, very good point. Now, there is that limitation, and I don't know what the limit is on the Rebels. Shooting video. I know on the...
10 minutes.
It's 10 minutes. Okay.
10 minutes of consecutive footage. They will shut themselves down.
They shut off.
DSLRs don't have time code incorporated into the camera as well. So
another problem.
Yeah, exactly. If he did plan on having three cameras and he did plan on having an editor, they would hope to have time code. But since he's probably not even recording audio in the first place, he's just playing to a track, like a song, it'll be a little easier to sync them all up. So as uncompelling as having three cameras in different spots standing on sticks or on the floor all by themselves may be, it still is a lot of footage. So he doesn't necessarily need an operator. Obviously, it'd be best if he had an operator or a Dina dolly or a jib or anything. But ultimately, if he's trying to go on the cheaper on the sly like I've done in the past, three T2i, Rebel T2i's, T3i's feels a little bit better, but T2i will get you done. It'll be good.
Really good tip. I thank you so much for calling in. There, that you from the mouth of experience there. So that's
all. Oh, and P.S. We actually shot a little pilot up in Portland about like 4 months ago for the network I work for.
Oh.
So he's up in Portland. I didn't even realize that until just now. So
that's neat. Fun. Oh, that's neat. You want to say anything about that?
Ovation TV. Ovation's the network. So Ovation TV. The show is called. One man's trash. It's literally like two teams of three, dumpster dive, and then create art out of it.
Oh, my God. Thanks, Jeremy.
Judged by an art panel.
Leo Laporte, like, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We were talking with Jeremy from Hollywood about the kind of how many motion pictures, television shows are starting to use digital cameras, traditional digital cameras. For production. He also mentioned, and this would be another one for our caller who wants to film his dance productions, fairly inexpensive cameras coming from a company called Black Magic. I probably would not recommend that for somebody who doesn't want to be on the bleeding edge, but we're looking at them with great interest. These Black Magic cameras are fairly inexpensive. They're like an SLR, but they're designed specifically for shooting video, and they're a lot less expensive. I mean, they're not cheap. We're talking the least expensive is $2,000, but they use Canon lenses, and they have a lot of the capabilities that you'd like as a to film motion pictures with. You know, one of the big issues now, though, is shooting Ultra HD, which these are, is not shooting, not getting the video, but then you then processing it. It's such big video, it bogs down all but the highest-end computers. 8888, ask Leo. That's the number. Bruce is next. He's in Manhattan Beach, California. Hi, Bruce. Leo Laporte here.
Hello, Leo.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir. What can I do for you?
I've got a HP Pavilion laptop.
Okay.
Running System 7.
Okay.
And when I sleep it, if I unplug it, it shuts down. If I hibernate it and then unplug it, it doesn't shut down.
Wait a minute. You mean unplug it from the wall?
Right. Uh-huh.
Well, when you unplug it from the wall, it's shutting down, believe me. Here's the difference. And this is actually the key to the difference between sleeping and hibernating, which you have discovered spontaneously. When you remove power from the computer, it is shut down. There's no way it's not shut down. But in the case of sleeping, the way it sleeps is it goes into the lowest power mode it can, but it still keeps the contents of RAM. You know, when you work with a computer, you get a number of different components. You got your hard drive where your programs and your data is stored. You got your CPU, your processor, that's doing all the work. And you have RAM, that's fast memory that the processor can access. When the processor wants to work with a document, it loads it into RAM because it's much faster to work with it in RAM. It goes back and forth very, very quickly. That's why you don't want to confuse storage, which is on the order of hundreds of megabytes or gigabytes, rather, maybe even a terabyte, with RAM memory. That's not the same as storage. And memory usually is 4 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes, 16 gigabytes. You don't need as much RAM because you're just working on. You're just running the programs you're running right now and the data you're working on right now. So when the computer sleeps, one unfortunate feature of RAM, it's very fast, but it needs to be refreshed. It needs to be electrically refreshed constantly or it will lose its contents. Hard drive's great that way. That's why you have a hard drive. Power down a hard drive, unplug the computer, put it in the back of your truck, drive across the country. All your data is still going to be in the hard drive. But not in the RAM. The RAM needed power to stay alive. So sleep mode is a low power mode that just continuously refreshes the RAM. It's usually 8 watts, something like that. Just a few watts just to keep that RAM fresh so that your program and your data are still there. When you wake up the computer, it can run pretty quickly. It doesn't have to do anything. It just wakes up the processor, turns on the screen, and says, I'm here. This stuff's in RAM. Let's keep working. Hibernate is designed to allow you to completely shut down the computer. Stop refreshing the RAM. And the reason it works is it takes what's in the RAM, this 4, 8, 16 gigs, and writes it to the hard drive. Now, when it writes it out to the hard drive, you can remove power because everything's on the hard drive. The hard drive, remember, is non-volatile is what we call it. It stores, even without power, it stores data, programs, and all of that. Drive across country, plug in the machine, turn it on. If you've hibernated it and it wakes from hibernate, the process is longer. It has to boot up, actually has to wake up the processor, but it doesn't have to reload the programs and data. It merely, in one big chunk, loads up the memory from the hard drive. So it gets back to work faster. And more importantly, it gets back to work at exactly the point you hibernated it. You don't have to boot Windows, load the program, load in the data, and then start working. So it speeds things up a little bit. I don't recommend hibernate. Many computers have problems with hibernate. So my suggestion is to absolutely go to the power saver control panel. Usually the default is probably the right choice. That will be, depends on the computer. But after some short period of time, 8 minutes, 15 minutes, the screen turns off. That's a big draw in power. That's going to save a lot of power. And then maybe the hard drives will stop. They'll go to sleep. And it'll slowly, over time, maybe over a half hour, power down non-essential systems. The only thing it does is it keeps the RAM refreshed. That is just a few watts. And that's fine if you're going to get back to work pretty quickly. If it's a week, I wouldn't use sleep. But overnight, that's fine. I don't recommend hibernate. If you're going to be gone for more than 24 hours and you want to save power, shut down the computer. That's the best thing to do.
Hibernation has all sorts of problems. In fact, one of the problems with the Surface Pro was it couldn't wake up from hibernate. It would lose its Wi-Fi signal. It was all sorts of messed up problems. And you'll see that with a lot of Windows machines. Just hibernate is not a good solution. It just doesn't work very well. My recommendation, sleep if you're going to be back within 24 hours. Shut down any other time. 8888-ASK, Leo, Ed in Crossville, Tennessee. You're next. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, Ed.
Please insert disk A into drive, A and then swap it out.
Remember that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about my 4S and how it has more computing power than my first six computers altogether.
Absolutely. Your phone has, in most cases, a quad-core processor running in the gigahertz to 2 gigahertz range. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible.
There's more storage, like 64 gigabyte would be awesome. But anyway, to my call, I called a few weeks ago and had a question about iTunes, and that worked out very, very well. Thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad we solved that problem.
And now I have a question about replacing a hard drive in a 15-inch MacBook Pro.
Okay.
I have seen, and I don't think there's any difference in the hard drives for Apple's or Windows machines. Somebody was trying to...
There isn't. They're formatted differently sometimes, but they're the same hardware.
Right. And if you install them, you have to format them anyway.
I have put in, I've replaced the hard drives in my MacBook Pro several times because in the early days I was replacing the spinning drives with SSDs. And and that's a nice upgrade. Is your hard drive dead or you just want more capacity or do you want more speed? What are you looking for?
Well, I don't know if it's dead or not, but it certainly isn't working, so it's dead to me.
So, all right, hang on. We'll answer your question in a second. Leo Laporte, we got to take a break. The Tech Guy, more of your calls still to come. Stay right here. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888-ASK. Leo, we were talking to Ed in Crossville, Tennessee about upgrading, actually replacing the hard drive in his MacBook. It's always a challenge, or can be a challenge, to replace the hard drive in a laptop because everything's packed so tight. I remember opening one of the early MacBook Airs, and a lot of things went boing, and I never really got it back together again. Not the same way. A little bit easier on the modern MacBooks. They have 10 screws. They're tiny and of different lengths, so keep track of them as you remove them. And then once you open it up, it's actually pretty straightforward to get to the hard drive. So do you want to know what hard drive I recommend?
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear the ding. I wasn't live.
Ding! Oh, you never stopped being live, my friend.
Oh,
I never turned you off, Ed. I kept you on the whole break.
I was the ham radio operator that called earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, you were backing up? Anyway.
get up. Here's where I get all of my Mac parts, memory and hard drives. It's from a company that specializes in Apple, and that's why I like them. It's called Otherworld Computing, and their website is macsales.com. They have a variety of third-party hard drives. I recommend putting in an SSD if you can afford it.
Because I was wondering about the Western Digitals and what the colors were. I know that Father Ballister went over it, but...
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was.
I think for that particular use, a green would be a good choice.
A green?
Yeah, in the laptop. So we actually talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Western Digital has decided to go with colors. They have a color chart for their different hard drives. Again, I would recommend, to save yourself heartache, buying it from MacSales.com because you can actually look up your model of Mac Pro and make sure you're getting one that's 100% compatible. It's not the hard drive, but the plugs, the size, the form factor that have to match. Laptops are very finicky.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, which is a great question, actually Western Digital has a comparison chart. Blues are performance and reliability for everyday computing. The greens are cool, quiet, and eco-friendly, which, by the way, is what you want in a laptop. Both of those are
The green is 5,400 RPM. By the way, they call it, when you look on the chart, it says how fast it spins. It says IntelliPower trademark. And I asked Russell, our IT guy, he said, yeah, that's their trademark term for 5,400 RPM.
Okay, that, the speed really doesn't matter because I'm blind, right. So I don't use graphics or anything.
No, and I'll tell you, you don't want to put a faster hard drive in a laptop in most cases because they're hotter. Heat.
Yeah.
So green is really good for a laptop. The blue and black are 7,200 RPM. The Scorpio blue is 52. It's confusing. Just get green.
You were talking about the speeds of computers used in different NASA-related stuff. That's the speed of government.
Far from the speed of light. No, but we were talking about NASA computers, and they do design them for very harsh conditions. And I'm not talking just vibration of a rocket launch, but it's the hard, you know, because you're a ham, it's that hard radiation coming from the sun.
Yeah.
And so they have to build special, they use special processors that are based on the PowerPC chip, not the Intel. In fact,
I use a special digital filter for encrypting my ham radio stuff, too. It works just as good on a cell phone. It's called a foam wind filter.
That's not digital, my friend. Hey, thanks for the call. 73, Ed. I appreciate it. Hi, George. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Thanks for hanging on.
Thank you. The question I have is actually for the Note 3 versus LG 3.
Okay.
What are the major differences between the two? Because I'm deciding on one of the two.
Ironically, you would expect that the screen on the G3 would be better. It's certainly higher resolution. It's quad resolution. It's the highest resolution screen made today. But a number of people who've used both say, in fact, the Galaxy screens are better. Whether it's the Note 3 or the Galaxy S5, they're OLED screens. They're crisper. They're brighter. The blacks are better. And even though they don't have as many pixels per inch, both have more than your eye can see, and that's all that matters. If you can't see the dot, it doesn't exist. So whether there's 10 in that spot or one doesn't matter. So I would say from a pure hardware point of view, I have a Note 3. I love the Note 3. Screen is every bit as good, maybe even better than the G3. There are other things about the G3 that are better than the Note 3. So remember, the Note 3 is a year old now. The Note 4 is coming out any minute now. It will use a faster processor. The G3 uses the fastest Qualcomm Snapdragon part right now available. It has a lot of RAM, which I think makes a big difference. More RAM than the Galaxy Note 3, 3 gigabytes. That does make a difference in speed. I think the G3 is also a little bit less gunked up. I stopped using Samsung phones. I really loved the Galaxy S2. I thought that was a great phone. Loved the S3. By the S4, Samsung was putting so much stuff on this phone and changed so many of the Google apps to Samsung apps that I was starting to dislike it. I like a purer Google experience, frankly. And the G3 is a little bit purer. LG has some customizations, but not as many. Camera-wise, I just read an interesting comparison that gave the Galaxy S5, that's not the same as the Note 3, but it's similar, a better camera as well. The G3 does some interesting things with laser focusing, but the phase detection that's in the S5, along with the contrast detection, seems to do a better job in both low and bright light. Now, the S3, again, the Note 3, rather, is an older phone. So can you wait till the Note 4 comes out?
How much longer is it supposed to take?
So within the next month, I'm pretty sure. That will be comparable in almost every way to the G3, and I say it would probably be a good alternative. The Note 3 is a little older. In that case, I'd pick the G3. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Sir Paul McCartney. I just found out from Heather Hammond that she's going to go see Sir Paul perform live on Thursday, the very last event at the old Candlestick Park. They're tearing it down immediately after the concert?
I don't know if immediately, but...
like Paul leaves in the wrecking ball?
Maybe.
Do you get to take a seat with you?
We should try. Oh, thanks. That reminds me, I'm going to bring a big pliers.
Bring pliers and a big bag so yes, they don't know what you've done. No, you can actually buy the seats now. You get a pair or three of those ugly, uncomfortable orange seats that I spent many an hour joyously watching the San Francisco Giants and the San Francisco 49ers. You and I were at the last Niners game there.
That's right. My butt still hurts, those uncomfortable seats.
Yeah, they're terrible seats. I asked Lisa, I said, well, because she's a Niners season ticket holder, so they get a special deal. I said, well, we should get some. She said, over my dead body. I am not sitting one more minute in those seats. Maybe I'll go. You're going to see Sir Paul, huh?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I wouldn't mind seeing him. Can he still rock and roll?
Oh, I've heard that, yes, he can. What? Because people saw him last year at Outside Lands and said he really,
really
brought it. And there's no opener. It's 2 to 3 hours of solid
ball. Beatles hits. Of course, many people know the Beatles' last live performance was in 1964 at Candlestick Park.
Ta-da.
So there you go. There's a little bit of history going on there. Let's take another call. What do you say? Andre on the line from, I'm sorry, Andrea on the line from Lakewood. It's such tiny print. Would you help me out, Heather? Is it Lakewood, Colorado or Lakewood, California?
California.
Hi, Andrea.
Hello. I was going to try and shoot the moon tonight, and I wanted you to know, give me some recommendations on the settings for my camera.
I'd stay well away from local law. Oh, you mean the super moon. Actually,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This is, I know I was teasing you. This is not only a good night to shoot the moon, but a good night to shoot the Pleiades meteor shower, because about 2 in the morning, if the skies are still clear, you should also see a bunch of shooting stars. That'd be kind of fun to get. So the key on shooting the moon, and I will put a link to a very good article on this, is, first of all, you're going to need a longer lens than you think. What kind of camera are you using? Not your smartphone, I hope.
A Rebel T3i.
Excellent. What's the longest lens you've got?
I think it goes to 300.
Oh, plenty. That's good. You have a tripod, of course.
No.
Okay. Well, you're going to find... That's fine. But you're going to have to find something stable to put it on. All right?
Okay.
So, because it's not going to be just a point it at the moon, press the button, click, and it's done. You're going to probably do a time exposure. The key with the moon is it's actually very bright in the night sky. So what you probably don't want to do, I have some really excellent articles on this. What you're probably going to want to do is have a long telephoto lens, because that way you will get the moon big. All the pictures of the moon you see are shot with, in many cases, 500 millimeters to 1,000 millimeters. That's how it's such a big image, right? But I think 300 is good. It's in there. You're also going to want to put it on a stable surface. You're going to zoom in to that full 300 millimeters, right?
Okay.
So when you zoom in that far, as you probably already know, you probably can't hold it steady enough. If you want to get the details, remember the moon is a very bright dot on a very dark background. So you're going to expose for the moon itself. And the camera might be fooled by the night sky, thinking, well, there's this bright dot, but what about this night sky? So if you have a dial on your camera that you can change the exposure manually, you might want to...
Do I put it on the night setting or the manual setting?
Well, here's the starting point. ISO 200.
Okay.
The smallest aperture you've got, F11, something like that, and 125th of a second. So that's a pretty standard shot. On a tripod, though, because of that low, 125th of a second is too slow to hold it handheld. So you're going to want to put it on a tripod. Try a test shot. Don't let auto, focus it manually if you can. If you set the focus to infinity, that's probably going to be good enough. The moon's pretty far away. Take a look. You're doing it digitally, right? So this is nice. You can at least take a look at that first shot. And then with that first shot, you'll know, is it too bright? Am I seeing the details I want? Because ideally, a moon shot should be big, fill the frame, or as much of it. You won't fill the frame at 300 millimeters, but you'll have a decent size, and you want to see the details. You want to see the mare and the
ejecta and all of the little details of that moon face, the man in the moon. And to do that, you need to expose it just right. You'll see immediately after you've taken that shot, at that basic shot, if it's too bright or too dark. And then most cameras have a way to add a stop, which will make it brighter, or take off a stop, which will make it darker. You might need to turn it down a couple of stops. I will put some articles. There are quite a few. In fact, if you just Google, you know, take moon picture of the moon, you'll find quite a few. I think with your 300 millimeters, you're good. You want the longest lens you can. The reason you want a an f-stop of 11 or 10 or 9 is for a couple of reasons, but you want as much in focus as possible, but you also want to block the light. You don't want too much bright. And then if you don't have a spot meter, a way to just measure that dot, many cameras you can say, just meter that dot, you can do that. But the key is to play with it, to play with it. And you're going to use your probably want to use your manual settings for this. Hey, good luck. What fun. And then do some bulb settings, some timed. I should have asked Chris Marquardt to help us with this one when he was here. Some you know, 1, 2, 5, 10 second exposures. Maybe make them even longer and see if you can get some shooting stars, too, from Pleiades. Good advice from the chat room. Open it up a little bit. You don't want a gray moon. The trick is you want a nice, bright, white moon, but you can also see the details. We'll put a lot of information in the show notes. There's a goodly amount of stuff, including Chris Marquardt's discussion of this, I think, last year when we had the supermoon. And we'll put a link to the Wikipedia page on the Looney 11 rule. In lunar photography, the Looney 11 rule is a method of estimating correct exposures without a light meter. Set it to F11. Shutter speed 1/200th or 250 with ISO 200. That's the Looney 11 rule. Alex in Rancho Cucamonga. Hi, Alex. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Hanging tough like new kids on the block.
That sounds like an old joke, but okay, keep going. What can I do for you?
I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the new Amazon phone.
Yeah, I have one, actually.
I'm not sure. I heard like there were some new features with the screen, like how the screen displays.
Yeah, I'll talk about it. I have one. I don't recommend it, but I'll tell you what's interesting about it. First of all, it has four cameras on the front face that are looking at you. And that allows it to do something called dynamic perspective. As you tilt the phone or move your head, you can look around things on the screen. It's very weird. People have called it 3D. It's not exactly 3D, but it does allow you to look around things. When you're on a map, you could actually tilt the phone a little bit, and the map will tilt a little bit. It's a gimmick. It's nice. It's interesting, but it's a gimmick. The other thing that the phone has is a Mayday feature, like the Amazon tablets. That's kind of cool. If it's your first smartphone or you need help, you can press a button, and within 15 seconds, a person will appear on the screen to help you. They also have the Firefly feature. Of course, it's Amazon. Lets you take a picture of something and buy it on Amazon. But all in all, I don't recommend it. There are better phones out there. It's interesting, but no cigar. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That's it for me. Have a great geek week. Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.